Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we argue that Canada's expansion of medically assisted dying reflects a deeper neoliberal logic on The Breach Show, assess the legacy of the Climate Emergency Unit on Green Majority, examine how anti-feminist narratives impact housing choices for women on Red Eye, and enjoy an unforgettable highlight from part 7 of the spectacular Seriously Wrong saga Genocide Apocalypse, The Injured Boy Inside. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Desmond Cole sits down with disability justice scholar and Invisible Institutions host Megan Linton to hear why Canada's expansion of medically assisted dying reflects a deeper neoliberal logic. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. For nearly a year, the federal government has been quiet about a scathing United Nations report on Canada's treatment of disabled people. The UN criticized Canada's expansion of medical assistance in dying, or MAID, as well as the inadequate financial supports for disabled people that make life so unlivable. What does Prime Minister Carney's austerity agenda mean for disabled folks in this country? Joining me to discuss that today is Megan Linton, a PhD candidate at Carleton University's Department of Sociology and Anthropology, and the creator and host of Invisible Institutions, a documentary podcast exploring the past and present of institutions for people labeled with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Canada. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And just before we get started, a reminder to our audiences to like and subscribe if you want more bold journalism for transformation. Megan, I want to start with the topic of medical assistance in dying, or MAID. It's been a legal practice in Canada for nearly a decade now, and it began as a practice of assisted death for people whose deaths were deemed to be reasonably foreseeable due to grievous and immediate medical conditions. So this is referred to as track one. But in 2021, the practice was expanded to include anyone suffering from a grievous and an irredeemable condition whose death was not reasonably foreseeable, as long as they were experiencing what the law calls substantial suffering. This is referred to as track two. So in 2024 alone, about 16,500 people chose to end their lives through MAID. And Megan, I want to ask you, how do you feel that this practice has changed the way we view life and death in this country?
I think that medical assistance in dying has radically transformed every way in which we view disability and chronic illness, along with pain and suffering of any form. And what I mean by that is that it's not just all disabled people who are already disabled who are impacted, but also all of those people who might become disabled through various possibilities, like a workplace accident, like getting really sick from COVID-19 and never fully recovering. And so I think once MAID has been planted as the response to disability as the response to the challenges that are super real. It is incredibly difficult for me as a wheelchair user to leave my house this winter. That is very real. That is a legitimate piece. And the ways in which our society has now been structured to alleviate those struggles is really devastating, because we're increasingly telling people that the easiest option is assisted suicide, as opposed to all of the different ways that so many disabled communities and non-disabled communities have been living through illness, disease, pain, suffering, accidents for so many centuries. And so this, I think, is particularly concerning because we're in this time where 10 years ago, when MAID was introduced, we were at a very different place in the political economy of health that we are post the COVID-19 pandemic and the continued neoliberalization of all of our state services. And so now we're in a place of very real suffering that is often manufactured, made worse, or refuse to be alleviated by state services. And then there's MAID, which it's there. There's articles on from doctors, from public health on how to support people in accessing MAID. And it's really difficult to find how to support yourself to survive in so many different ways. But there are ways, but they require a lot more support and a lot more effort than just a quick Google search. And all of these lobbying organizations have all of these documents ready for you if you choose to die by assisted suicide.
Well, you've described this as a limiting of imagination. And I wonder if you can expand on that, what you mean that this condition, this state that we're in, is limiting our imagination when we think about disability and the lives that people can live.
Yeah, I was going through some of the coroner's investigations that the province of Ontario's Office of the Chief Coroner did following the 2024 MAID counts. And I think it like really devastated me, because you can see yourself, and everyone, disabled and non-disabled, can see themselves in these stories where they say, I became disabled, and then within the year, I died by suicide because I was causing caregiver burden on my partner. How devastating is that? That we think that our lives, that disabled lives, that the lives of people who are sick, who have terminal illnesses, are burdens, as opposed to these incredibly real gifts that offer so much. And I think like that is the thing about disability, is that it offers you a million, a billion possible ways of living, of surviving, of caring for each other, of teaching your neighbor how important it is that they are able to shovel their driveway quickly so you can leave the house. And all of those things are actually very tangible pieces of how our society thrives. And if instead our society is limited to the fact that if someone is so sick, then they should die by suicide, then that is so grievous to all of these ways of life that give us so much. I think about my uncle, who's my favorite person in the world. He was given a terminal diagnosis at 16, and he's still alive. He's really struggled in his life because of the ways in which we construct illness. But he brought me so much joy. And as a person becoming disabled, I always think of him as a point of strength, as a point of dignity, as a point of perseverance. And those are pieces that help me survive. They help my friends who are non-disabled and just like trying to survive in this really broken world. And so I think disability offers us all of these amazing possibilities of life. I grieve for the community and for all the people, disabled and non-disabled and families and kin, who have suffered as a result of this, whether it's upon a diagnosis and feeling like this is the best option and I am a burden, or upon years of suffering and struggling to know that there's other possibilities for care. Like the amount of work I do to just show people the possibilities of care that are out there that are funded, but just are privatized into all of these different little sectors, that it's so hard to find. This limitation of our imagination is coming at a time, you know, there's like all of these ways that we're limiting our imagination, whether it's like AI, whether it's made all of these pieces, and they fit together because it's teaching us that what we think, what we say, what we do, our inherent worth as humans is not good enough. We actually should just be machines, and then maybe we'd be able to function a little better, not be a burden. We are watching a fundamental degradation of our imaginations, and disability is a really amazing fundamental piece to this. And the fact that MAID is happening at this time is a part of this loss of belief in each other, this loss of community capacity to dream and build, and this capacity for each other to show up and be real and be there and know how to show up when people are sick, when people are hurting, when people are injured, which is a really important skill.
You mentioned that your uncle was given a terminal diagnosis at 16. Do you mind me asking me how old he is today?
He is 64, maybe 66. It was his birthday recently, but I'll give him 64.
Now, the vast majority of MAID provisions in Canada fall under track one, and that is deaths deemed to be reasonably foreseeable by a healthcare expert, as opposed to a minority of provisions that fall under track two, people who accessed MAID even though doctors and specialists didn't see their conditions as terminal. So what should we make of these two different categories of MAID and how they're being used?
Yeah, I think that we often deem one of them as like good and worthy of our efforts, and one of them as a step too far and the government like intervening in people's lives a bit too much. And so I think the differences in track one and track two, I am concerned about them. 50% of people who received MAID in the track one category had pain that wasn't managed. Like, that is horrifying. Someone's at the end of their life and you're not giving them opioids because you're scared that they're going to be addicted to them. Like, I can't say for certain that that's the path, but based on the stories of disabled people I know, even when they have a terminal diagnosis, the like prescription of opioids, if they're in a certain class of people, is not possible. And so like 50% of people dying by MAID do not have their pain managed under track one. Like, that's absurd to me. I'm a death doula. I like do a lot of death care. I find it difficult to find words once again, but I think it's a level of cruelty that the medical system is enacting every day. And if you're not someone who's engaging every day in the medical system, you might not necessarily see it or feel the ways in which it grinds you down. But the medical system right now is not functioning to care for people. It is functioning at its least possible capacity. Like, it is completely overrun. Everything possible is terrible within the healthcare system. And we have so many doctors who are giving, whose like sole procedures are killing people when there's people who need life-saving surgeries. And so when there's people who might not want to die if their pain was managed, and it's possible. Pain management is so possible. And we have so many concerns about how pain management works such that we make it very difficult for it to happen. I'm going to quickly go into the fact that doctors are prescribing medical assistance and dying when people have psychiatric labels. That is supposed to be not legalized. And yet, reviewing multiple different coroner's reports from different provinces shows that doctors are ending people's lives following psychiatric admissions, with the majority of diagnoses being psychiatric.
Despite the fact that the federal government says right now it is only considering expanding MAID to include these kinds of mental illness as the only underlying condition, and it's not supposed to be legal to do that at this point, correct?
No, it is not supposed to be legal to assist someone in their suicide if their sole underlying condition is mental illness. And there are many conditions that we would never assume are like IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's so many memes on the internet. Hot girls have IBS, all of these things. You know, we talk about IBS very colloquially. But I think like why I brought this up is that the way in which medical practitioners engage in lots of different forms of bureaucracy within this process is messy and is not smooth. It is a lot more chaotic than it appears. And I think we see this when they say there's no system to determine, no like shared system to determine if someone is suicidal at the time of their mate intake. As I said at the beginning, we're in a moment where the political economy of health has fundamentally been broken and reshaped by the COVID-19 pandemic and the absolute decimation of services that happened in that time. And as a result of the cuts that happened and continue to happen, of the millions and billions that aren't invested in the services that are out there, like the healthcare services, is that people are getting sicker and people are having to wait longer to get terminal diagnoses, to get diagnoses. All of this system of bureaucratization of death and of the determination of life and what is within the categories of a life that is not terminal is that we can't say for sure, because all of our systems have been gutted so drastically that we are putting people in a position where they have terminal diagnoses at a much higher rate.
That was a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com, and find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. You listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station from Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Since launching in Toronto in 2006, Green Majority has become Canada's longest-running weekly environmental news hour, helping transform the environmental movement into a social justice-oriented push for a sustainable society. On this highlight from a recent episode, co-host Stefan Hostetter sits down with Seth Klein for a conversation about what the legacy of the Climate Emergency Unit will teach climate campaigners going forward. Here's the show.
Welcome to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, or perhaps one of our greatly appreciated radio syndicates across the country. Or perhaps you found us on the podcast, which can be found anywhere podcasts can be found, including the Harbinger Media Network. I am here with Seth Klein, the former team lead of the Climate Emergency Unit. We'll get into why in a couple seconds, and also author of The Good War. He's also a semi-regular columnist with Canada's National Observer. Thanks so much for being here, Seth.
Nice to be back with you, Stefan.
We talked really at the beginning of the five-year journey that the CEU sort of set embarked upon. And one of the questions we talked about then was how interesting it was to give yourself a time frame that we're doing this for 5 years. And so this is the end of that those 5 years. And we thought it'd be really interesting to get a catch-up about what you've learned and all that's happened in between. But to start really high level, in case folks haven't listened to that podcast 5 years ago, maybe you can tell us what the CEU is and why you started it.
Is or was, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. So as you mentioned off the top, I wrote this book a little more than 5 years ago called A Good War, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency. And the framework of the book was drawing lessons from a previous mobilization across society, namely the mobilization against fascism in the Second World War. And it was trying to apply lessons for mobilizing for the climate emergency. You know, I knew upon writing that book, I wanted to spend the next years animating the ideas in the book. And the book is filled with, I think, ideas of what represent genuine climate emergency actions and policies. As soon as the book was out, I started to meet with political leaders across the country. And these were kind of fun chats. It turns out a lot of them are World War II buffs. But really nothing was going to happen out of these, right? That change doesn't happen unless meetings like that are backed up with a drumbeat of pressure from different sectors of society saying, we need to make this happen. So I realized I needed some sort of an institutional home again to do that kind of work. And cooked up this idea with David Suzuki and Tara Cullis, his partner, who ended up giving me a home in the David Suzuki Institute to create this thing called the Climate Emergency Unit, the whole idea of which would be to build that drumbeat, to forge coalitions and joint initiatives around the emergency ideas in the book, and to bring the emergency to these efforts. And in particular, the idea was to, you know, we didn't aspire to directly mobilize individuals but rather to organize organizations, to bring them together into these coalitions, and in particular to try to draw in organizations from outside the traditional environmental sector based on this appreciation that we're not going to win this thing if it's just environment and climate groups pushing. We need health groups and student groups and labor groups and faith institutions and so on. So that was the idea. That's when we launched 5 years ago. And as you said off the top too, we decided to structure it by design as a 5-year project, which is a bit unusual. And now that it's over, it's sort of bittersweet, but I'm actually really glad that we did it that way. Maybe we can talk more about it.
Yeah, honestly, that is my next question, which is about this idea. Because I mean, I don't know if you drew inspiration from another organizations that have done this sort of structure, or if this is an idea that you had, because it is fascinating. And especially, you know, I've done some interviews with some folks who have been leaving other climate organizations at different times. And one of the thoughts that they gave to me was, well, I think that our organization has run its course and we need to pull back to give new space for new things. And I'm sure it's very hard, but to structure it in from the jump is so interesting. So yeah, can you talk about that thinking and how it's played out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had worked for 22 years before that with a public policy think tank. So I too was more used to a model where you're a going concern and you're always fundraising and trying to maintain oneself for the long term. You mentioned that you've heard of organizations that have thought maybe we've come to the end of the line, it's hard to wind down. Even within existing organizations, it's hard to do that with projects, not just organizations, because there's always this, you know, once you start doing something, there's a kind of status quo bias to just keep doing it. I'd like to say that, you know, this was some brilliant strategic insight to structure it as a 5-year project. It wasn't really. We kind of stumbled into it. There were a number of reasons why we did it that way and a number of benefits that derived from that, only some of which we appreciated at the outset. So first of all, we liked the idea of a model that would communicate the message. The message being, it's a goddamn emergency and we need to accomplish some big things quickly. And the model allowed for that. It also meant that we had very low administrative needs. Like throughout that whole 5-year period, we had no admin staff, we had no HR staff, we had no fundraising staff. All of us on the team were focused almost exclusively on campaigning. And we basically contracted for like 5 hours a month of admin help. It also meant that we, you know, there's a lot of things that organizations have to do when they're sticking around. Thorny things they have to wrestle with, hard questions, you know, HR policies and all kinds of things that can sometimes really suck a lot of energy. And I'm not dissing it, like these are important things. But for us, we just didn't bother because why would we? The other benefit is that it meant we didn't need to invest time and effort building our brand recognition. Because why would we? We weren't going to stick around, nor did we put efforts into growing an individual donor base, because that wasn't the model. That had real advantages, because if the whole raison d'etre for the CEU was to bring together coalitions, we were able to be this kind of safe, non-compete place. We were happy for other people to capitalize on these campaigns and to apply their own brands to these campaigns. And we weren't going to compete with them for individual donors. I think it also allowed us to take some risks because we weren't sticking around. And I guess the final thing I'd say about this, one of the messages and urgings, both in my book and in the work of the Climate Emergency Unit, a really core invocation to our friends in the climate movement, is to stop doing what isn't working. And as you say, this 5-year model effectively built that right into our DNA. We would stop doing what isn't working.
I want to dive a little bit deeper into that. And one of the reasons I'd be curious why that might be possible for you, which is to not have to fundraise. Like the ways in which our fundraising systems are designed, partially, as you mentioned, to keep the same program going, because it's so much easier to get continued funding than new funding. You know, like if you've got a proven model, proven partner who wants to do a project, you're able to sort of build that continually, whereas it's sometimes much harder to go find new partners to do new stuff. There's a bit of a bias there too. Sometimes people only want some fun new stuff. But I do think that not having to build in your expectations to funders, to be able to see, be like, okay, this is what's working for us. We see it's working. We can pivot right away versus a year down the road in a granting cycle, something like that. It strikes me as Gate would give you a lot more flexibility.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't want to misrepresent it. We did have to fundraise. Okay. We did secure foundation support for a number of our projects. Although, I would say we were able to do it in a generous way. Like, the surplus is left with the CEU. We are passing on to campaigns that need to continue. What we didn't do is build up an individual donor base. Like, if you were getting the CEU newsletter, you were only invited to consider making a donation once or twice a year. And again, I'm not criticizing other groups, because if you are sticking around, you really need an individual donor base, that, you know, many small donors who you can count on to stay with you long term. The challenge is that if that's the path you're going, you need a couple, at least a couple staff who just tend to that donor base. And we didn't have that or do that.
I appreciate the clarification. And so I have one last sort of ground setting before we dive into the experience of the 5 years, which is, just quickly, you sort of speak a little bit about the principles that guided your thinking. And I wonder if you can just sort of lay those out. Like, what did you use to build the plan?
There were a few core tenets that guided, that were kind of the guiding ethos right out of the gate. One, I've already mentioned, we did not want to build our own brand. And in particular, as we were initiating campaigns, we were always happiest if somebody else led them. So for example, CAPE, the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, lead a campaign to ban fossil fuel advertising, but we initiated that and encouraged them to lead it because there was a logic to a health organization leading a campaign like that. And they gratefully said yes and have been doing a great job. We initiated the BC Climate Emergency Campaign, but it's really its own thing now. So that was one piece of it. Relatedly, there was this core tenet that was about focusing on coalition building, really trying to reinforce this core message that no worthwhile policy change is ever going to be won alone. And that therefore we really wanted to spend our time cajoling our movement allies, not to focus their resources only on their own individual campaigns, but to join with others in common cause. And to join, as I said earlier, with organizations from outside just the climate movement. Another piece of the ethos was just, and I said it before, bring the emergency. To consistently push our movement not to settle for half measures or incremental wins, but to focus our collective efforts on wins that are climactically and economically and politically consequential. But in doing that work, we wanted to be seen, even if it meant sometimes being kind of constructively critical of friends and allies, we wanted to be seen as firm but fair, both by our movement, other movement orgs, and by elected leaders. That we were going to push and say when something was too incremental, but we wanted to be seen as fair and reasonable about it. Another key tenet, and again, it is derived from these lessons I took from our World War II mobilization in my book, is to drive home, and this is a key lesson from the Second World War mobilization, that attaining transformation at true speed and scale requires state leadership. You know, and you see this playing out, for example, one of our core campaigns has been the campaign for Youth Climate Corps. Now, as we've pressed governments provincially and federally for this, the easiest thing for a government to do is to just cut a check to some nonprofit group to run the damn thing. And we keep saying, that's not a transformative win. We don't need another nonprofit. We are only going to hit speed and scale with new public corporations, new public programs, and state leadership that actually get us there. You know, those were some of the guiding tenets. And then, one final thing I should say is all of this came together in a framework that we adopted early on, derived from the book, which we call the six markers of emergency. We kind of pulled out, what are the key markers? We probably talked about this on our last interview, the key markers of when the government or any large institution and its leadership are actually in emergency mode. And those six markers are: you spend what it takes to win, you create new public institutions to get the job done, you move from voluntary to mandatory measures as needed, you commit to tell the truth, you commit to leave no one behind, and you center Indigenous rights and title and leadership. That framework